his cousin, if Hinkert was his cousin. Being Spanish, he got little support. Most of the time, from one quarter or another, his life was in danger. Still, he tried four times to assassinate Orange's postmaster, though without success. Jan Hinkert was dispossessed by Farnese, and Leonard I, the Turin and Taxis Grand Master, reinstated. But it had been a time of great instability for the Turin and Taxis monopoly. Leery of strong Protestant leanings in the Bohemian branch of the family, the Emperor, Rudolf II, had for a time withdrawn his patronage. The postal operation plunged deeply into the red. It may have been some vision of the continent-wide power structure Hinkert could have taken over, now momentarily weakened and tottering, that inspired Tristero to set up his own system. He seems to have been highly unstable, apt at any time to appear at a public function and begin a speech. His constant theme, disinheritance. The postal monopoly belonged to O'Han by right of conquest, and O'Han belonged to Tristero by right of blood. He styled himself El Desheredado, the disinherited, and fashioned a livery of black for his followers. Black to symbolize the only thing that truly belonged to them in their exile, the knight. Soon he had added to his iconography the muted post horn and a dead badger with its 4 feet in the air. Some said that the name Taxis came from the Italian tasso, badger, referring to hats of badger fur the early Bergamaschan couriers wore. He began a sub rosa campaign of obstruction, terror, and depredation along the Turin and Taxis mail routes. Edeva spent the next several days in and out of libraries and earnest discussions with Emery Bortz and Genghis Cohen. She feared a little for their security in view of what was happening to everyone else she knew. The day after reading Blob's peregrinations, she, with Bortz, Grace, and the graduate students, attended Randolph Driblet's burial, listened to a younger brother's helpless, stricken eulogy, watched the mother, spectral in afternoon smog, cry, and came back at night to sit on the grave and drink Napa Valley Muscatel, which Driblet in his time had put away barrels of. There was no moon. Smog covered the stars, all black as a Tristero rider. Oedipus sat on the earth, ass getting cold, wondering whether, as Driblet had suggested that night from the shower, some version of herself hadn't vanished with him. Perhaps her mind would go on flexing psychic muscles that no longer existed, would be betrayed and mocked by a phantom self, as the amputee is by a phantom limb. Someday she might replace whatever of her had gone away by some prosthetic device, a dress of a certain color, a phrase in a letter, another lover. She tried to reach out to whatever coated tenacity of protein might improbably have held on 6 feet below, still resisting decay, any stubborn quiescence, perhaps gathering itself for some last burst, some last scramble up through earth, just glimmering, holding together with its final strength a transient winged shape, needing to settle at once in the warm host or dissipate forever into the dark. "If you come to me," prayed Oedipa, "bring your memories of the last night. Or if you have to keep down your payload, the last 5 minutes, that may be enough. But so I'll know if your walk into the sea had anything to do with Tristero. If they got rid of you for the reason they got rid of Hilarius and Mucho and Metzger, maybe because they thought I no longer needed you. They were wrong. I needed you. Only bring me that memory, and you can live with me for whatever time I've got." She remembered his head floating in the shower, saying, You could fall in love with me. But could she have saved him? She looked over at the girl who'd given her the news of his death. Had they been in love? Did she know why Driblette had put in those two extra lines that night? Had he even known why? No one could begin to trace it. 100 hang-ups, permuted, combined. Sex, money, illness, despair with the history of his time and place. Who knew? Changing the script had no clearer motive than his suicide. There was the same whimsy to both. Perhaps she felt briefly penetrated, as if the bright winged thing had actually made it to the sanctuary of her heart. Perhaps springing from the same slick labyrinth, adding those two lines had even, in a way never to be explained, served him as a rehearsal for his night's walk away into that vast sink of the primal blood, the Pacific. She waited for the winged brightness to announce its safe arrival, but there was silence. "Driblette," she called, the signal echoing down twisted miles of brain circuitry. "Driblette!" But as with Maxwell's demon, so now. Either she could not communicate, or he did not exist. Beyond its origins, the libraries told her nothing more about Tristero. For all they knew, it had never survived the struggle for Dutch independence. To find the rest, she had to approach from the Turn and Toxis side. This had its perils. For Emery Bortz, it seemed to turn into a species of cute game. He held, for instance, to a mirror image theory, by which any period of instability for Turn and Toxis must have its reflection in Tristero's shadow state. He applied this to the mystery of why the dread name should have appeared in print only around the middle of the 17th century. How had the author of the pun on This Tristero Dies Irae overcome his reluctance? How had half the Vatican couplet, with its suppression of the Tristero line, found its way into the folio? Whence had the daring of even hinting at a Turn and Toxis rival come? Bortz maintained there must have been some crisis inside Tristero, grave enough to keep them from retaliating, perhaps the same that kept them from taking the life of Dr. Blob. But should Bortz have exfoliated the mere word so lushly into such unnatural roses, under which, in whose red-scented dusk, dark history slithered unseen? When Leonard II, Francis, Count of Turn and Toxis, died in 1628, his wife Alexandrine of Rye succeeded him in name as postmaster, though her tenure was never considered official. She retired in 1645. The actual locus of power in the monopoly remained uncertain until 1650, when the next male heir, Lamoral II, Claude Francis, took over. Meanwhile, in Brussels and Antwerp, signs of decay in the system had appeared. Private local posts had encroached so far on the imperial licenses that the two cities shut down their Turn and Toxis offices. How, Bortz asked, would Tristero have responded? Postulating then some militant faction proclaiming the great moment finally at hand, advocating a takeover by force while their enemy was vulnerable. But conservative opinion would care only to continue in opposition, exactly as the Tristero had these 70 years. There might also be, say, a few visionaries, men above the immediacy of their time, who could think historically. At least one among them, hip enough to foresee the end of the 30 Years' War, the Peace of Westphalia, the breakup of the empire, the coming descent into particularism. "He looks like Kirk Douglas," cried Bortz. "He's wearing this sword. His name is something gutsy like Conrad. They're meeting in the back room of a tavern, all these broads in peasant blouses carrying steins around, everybody juiced and yelling. Suddenly, Conrad jumps up on a table. The crowd hushes. "The salvation of Europe," Conrad says, "depends on communication, right? We face this anarchy of jealous German princes, hundreds of them, scheming, counter-scheming, infighting, dissipating all of the empire's strengths in their useless bickering. But whoever could control the lines of communication among all these princes would control them. That network someday could unify the continent. So I propose that we merge with our old enemy, Torn and Toxis." Cries of, "No, never, throw the traitor out." Till this barmaid, little starlet, sweet on Conrad, cold conks with a stein, his loudest antagonist. Together, Conrad is saying, our two systems could be invincible. We could refuse service on any but an imperial basis. Nobody could move troops, farm produce, anything without us. Any prince tries to start his own courier system, we suppress it. We, who have been so long disinherited, could be the heirs of Europe. Prolonged cheering. But they didn't keep the empire from falling apart, Edipa pointed out. So, Bort's backing off, the militants and the conservatives fight to a standstill. Conrad and his little group of visionaries, being nice guys, try to mediate the hassle. By the time they all get squared away again, everybody's played out. The Empire's had it. Torn and Toxis wants no deals. And with the end of the Holy Roman Empire, the fountainhead of Torn and Toxis' legitimacy is lost forever among the other splendid delusions. Probabilities for paranoia become abundant. If Tristero had managed to maintain even partial secrecy, if Turn and Toxis have no clear idea who their adversary is or how far its influence extends, then many of them must come to believe in something very like the Skirvamite's blind, automatic anti-god. Whatever it is, it has the power to murder their riders, send landslides thundering across their roads, by extension, bring into being new local competition, and presently even state postal monopolies, disintegrate their empire. It is their time's ghost, out to put the Turn and Toxis ass in a sling. But over the next century and a half, the paranoia recedes as they come to discover the secular Tristero. Power, omniscience, implacable malice, attributes of what they'd thought to be a historical principle, a zeitgeist, are carried over to the now human enemy. So much that, by 1795, it is even suggested that Tristero has staged the entire French Revolution just for an excuse to issue the proclamation of 9th Frimaire Antois, ratifying the end of the Turn and Toxis postal monopoly in France and the lowlands. Suggested by who, though? Said Edipa. Did you read that someplace?
Wouldn't somebody have brought it up?
Bort said.
Maybe not.
She didn't press the argument, having begun to feel reluctant about following up anything. She hadn't asked Genghis Cohen, for example, if his expert committee had ever reported back on the stamps he'd sent them. She knew that if she went back to Vesperhaven House to talk again to old Mr. Thoth about his grandfather, she would find that he, too, had died. She knew she ought to write to K. Da Chingado, publisher of the unaccountable paperback Courier's Tragedy, but she didn't, and never asked Bortz if he had either. Worst of all, she found herself going often to absurd lengths to avoid talking about Randolph Driblet. Whenever the girl showed up, the one who'd been at the wakes, Edipa found excuses to leave the gathering. She felt she was betraying Driblet and herself, but left it alone, anxious that her revelation not expand beyond a certain point. lest possibly it grow larger than she and assume her to itself. When Bortz asked her one evening if he could bring in D'Amico, who was at NYU, Oedipa told him no, too fast, too nervous. He didn't mention it again, and neither, of course, did she. She did go back to the scope, though, one night, restless, alone, leery of what she might find. She found Mike Fallopian, a couple weeks into raising a beard, wearing button-down olive shirt, creased fatigue pants minus cuffs and belt loops, two-button fatigue jacket, no hat. He was surrounded by broads, drinking champagne cocktails and bellowing low songs. When he spotted Oedipa, he gave her the wide grin and waved her over. "You look," she said. "Wow, like you're all on the move, training rebels up in the mountains." Hostile looks from the girls twined around what parts of Fallopian were accessible. "It's a revolutionary secret," he laughed, throwing up his arms and flinging off a couple of camp followers. "Go on now, all of you. I want to talk to this one." When they were out of earshot, he swiveled on her a look sympathetic, annoyed, perhaps also a little erotic. "How's your quest?" She gave him a quick status report. He kept quiet while she talked, his expression slowly changing to something she couldn't recognize. It bothered her. To jog him a little, she said, "I'm surprised you people aren't using the system, too." "Are we an underground?" he came back, mild enough. "Are we rejects?" "I didn't mean..." "Maybe we haven't found them yet," said Fallopian. "Or maybe they haven't approached us. Or maybe we are using WASTE, only it's a secret." Then, as electronic music began to percolate into the room, "But there's another angle, too." She sensed what he was going to say and began reflexively to grind together her back molars, a nervous habit she'd developed in the last few days. "Has it ever occurred to you, Oedipa, that somebody's putting you on? That this is all a hoax? Maybe something Inverarity set up before he died?" It had occurred to her, but like the thought that someday she would have to die, Oedipa had been steadfastly refusing to look at that possibility directly, or in any but the most accidental of lights. "No," she said. "That's ridiculous." Fallopian watched her, nothing if not compassionate. "You ought," quietly. "Really, you ought to think about it. Write down what you can't deny, your hard intelligence, but then write down what you've only speculated, assumed. See what you've got. At least that." "Go ahead," she said, cold. "At least that. What else after that?" He smiled, perhaps now trying to salvage whatever was going soundlessly smash, its net of invisible cracks propagating leisurely through the air between them. "Please don't be mad." "Verify my sources, I suppose," Oedipa kept on pleasantly. "Right?" He didn't say any more. She stood up, wondering if her hair was in place, if she looked rejected or hysterical, if they'd been causing a scene. "I knew you'd be different," she said. "Mike, because everybody's been changing on me. But it hadn't gone as far as hating me." "Hating you?" He shook his head and laughed. "If you need any armbands or more weapons, do try Winthrop Tremaine over by the freeway. Tremaine's swastika shop. Mention my name." "We're already in touch, thanks." She left him in his modified Cuban ensemble, watching the floor, waiting for his broads to come back. "Well, what about her sources?" She was avoiding the question, yes. One day, Genghis Cohen called, sounding excited, and asked her to come see something he just got in the mail, the U.S. mail. It turned out to be an old American stamp bearing the device of the muted post horn, belly-up badger, and the motto, "We await silent Tristero's empire." "So that's what it stands for," said Edipa. "Where did you get this?"
"A friend," Cohen said, leafing through a battered Scott catalog. "In San Francisco."
As usual, she did not go on to ask for any name or address.
"Odd. He said he couldn't find the stamp listed, but here it is. An addendum. Look."
In the front of the book, a slip of paper had been pasted in. The stamp, designated 163L1, was reproduced under the title Tristero Rapid Post, San Francisco, California, and should have been inserted between local listings 139, the 3rd Avenue Post Office of New York, and 140, Union Post, also of New York. Edipa, off on a kind of intuitive high, went immediately to the end paper in back and found the sticker of Zapp's used books.
"Sure," Cohen protested. "I drove out there one day to see Mr. Metzger while you were up north. This is the Scott Specialized, you see, for American stamps, a catalog I don't generally keep up on, my field being European and colonial. But my curiosity had been aroused, so..."
"Sure," Edipa said. Anybody could paste in an addendum. She drove back to San Narciso to have another look at the list of Inverarity's assets. Sure enough, the whole shopping center that housed Zapp's used books and Tremaine's surplus place had been owned by Pierce. Not only that, but the Tank Theater also.
"Okay," Edipa told herself, stalking around the room, her viscera hollow, waiting on something truly terrible. "Okay. It's unavoidable, isn't it? Every access route to the Tristero could be traced also back to the Inverarity estate. Even Emery Bortz, with his copy of Blob's Peregrinations, bought she had no doubt he'd tell her in the event she asked, also at Zapp's. Taught now at San Narciso College, heavily endowed by the dead man."
"Meaning what?"
"That Bortz, along with Metzger, Cohen, Driblett, Kotex, the tattooed sailor in San Francisco, the WASTE carriers she'd seen, that all of them were Pierce Inverarity's men?
Bought?
Or loyal, for free, for fun, to some grandiose practical joke he'd cooked up, all for her embarrassment, or terrorizing, or moral improvement? Change your name to Miles, Dean, Serge, and or Leonard, baby," she advised her reflection in the half-light of that afternoon's vanity mirror. "Either way, they'll call it paranoia."
"They. Either you have stumbled indeed, without the aid of LSD or other indole alkaloids, into a secret richness that concealed density of dream, onto a network by which X number of Americans are truly communicating whilst reserving their lies, recitations of routine, arid betrayals of spiritual poverty for the official government delivery system, maybe even onto a real alternative to the exitlessness, to the absence of surprise to life that harrows the head of everybody American you know, and you too, sweetie. Or you are hallucinating it. Or a plot has been mounted against you, so expensive and elaborate, involving items like the forging of stamps and ancient books, constant surveillance of your movements, planting of post-horn images all over San Francisco, bribing of librarians, hiring of professional actors, and Pierce Inverarity only knows what all besides, all financed out of the estate in a way
either too secret or too involved for your non-legal mind to know about, even though you are co-executor, so labyrinthine that it must have meaning beyond just a practical joke. Or you are fantasying some such plot, in which case you are a nut, Oedipa, out of your skull. Those, now that she was looking at them, she saw to be the alternatives. Those symmetrical four. She didn't like any of them, but hoped she was mentally ill, that's all it was. That night, she sat for hours, too numb even to drink, teaching herself to breathe in a vacuum. For this, oh God, was the void. There was nobody who could help her. Nobody in the world. They were all on something, mad, possible enemies, dead. Old fillings in her teeth began to bother her. She would spend nights staring at a ceiling lit by the pink glow of San Narciso's sky. Other nights, she could sleep for 18 drugged hours and wake enervated, hardly able to stand. In conferences with the keen, fast-talking old man who was new counsel for the estate, her attention span could often be measured in seconds, and she laughed nervously more than she spoke. Waves of nausea lasting 5 to 10 minutes would strike her at random, cause her deep misery, then vanish as if they had never been. There were headaches, nightmares, menstrual pains. One day she drove into L.A., picked a doctor at random from the phone book, went to her, told her she thought she was pregnant. They arranged for tests. Oedipa gave her name as Grace Bortz and didn't show up for her next appointment. Genghis Cohen, once so shy, now seemed to come up with new goodies every other day. A listing in an outdated Zumstein catalog. A friend in the Royal Philatelic Society's dim memory of some muted posthorn spied in the catalog of an auction held at Dresden in 1923. One day a typescript sent him by another friend in New York. It was supposed to be a translation of an article from an 1865 issue of the famous Bibliothèque des Tombophiles of Jean-Baptiste Moens. Reading like another of Bortz's costume dramas, it told of a great schism in the Tristero ranks during the French Revolution. According to the recently discovered and decrypted journals of the Comte Raoul Antoine de Vouget, Marquis de Tours et Tassis, one element among the Tristero had never accepted the passing of the Holy Roman Empire and saw the revolution as a temporary madness. Feeling obliged, as fellow aristocrats, to help Tourne and Taxis weather its troubles, they put out probes to see if the house was interested at all in being subsidized. This move split the Tristero wide open. At a convention held in Milan, arguments raged for a week. Lifelong enmities were created. Families divided, blood spilt. At the end of it, a resolution to subsidize Tourne and Taxis failed. Many conservatives, taking this as a millennial judgment against them, ended their association with the Tristero. Thus, the article smugly concluded, did the organization enter the penumbra of historical eclipse. From the Battle of Austerlitz until the difficulties of 1848, the Tristero drifted on, deprived of nearly all the noble patronage that had sustained them. Now reduced to handling anarchist correspondence, only peripherally engaged. In Germany, with the ill-fated Frankfurt Assembly, in Budapest at the barricades, perhaps even among the watchmakers of the Jura, preparing them for the coming of M. Bakunin. By far the greatest number, however, fled to America during 1849 through 50, where they are no doubt at present rendering their services to those who seek to extinguish the flame of revolution. less excited than she might have been even a week ago, Oedipa showed the piece to Emery Bortz. "All the Tristero refugees from the 1849 reaction arrive in America," it seemed to him. "Full of high hopes. Only what do they find?" Not really asking, it was part of his game. Trouble. Around 1845, the U.S. government had carried out a great postal reform, cutting their rates, putting most independent mail routes out of business. By the 70s and 80s, any independent carrier that tried to compete with the government was immediately squashed. 1849 through 50 was no time for any immigrating Tristero to get ideas about picking up where they'd left off back in Europe. "So they simply stay on," Bort said, "in the context of conspiracy. Other immigrants come to America looking for freedom from tyranny, acceptance by the culture, assimilation into it, this melting pot. Civil War comes along, most of them, being liberals, sign up to fight to preserve the Union, but clearly not the Tristero. All they've done is to change oppositions. By 1861, they're well established, not about to be suppressed. While the Pony Express is defying deserts, savages, and sidewinders, Tristero's giving its employees crash courses in Siouan and Athabascan dialects. Disguised as Indians, their messengers mosey westward. Reach the coast every time, zero attrition rate, not a scratch on them. Their entire emphasis now toward silence, impersonation, opposition masquerading as allegiance." What about that stamp of Cohen's, "We await silent Tristero's empire"? They were more open in their youth. Later, as the feds cracked down, they went over to stamps that were almost kosher-looking, but not quite. Oedipa knew them by heart. In the 15-cent dark green from the 1893 Columbian Exposition issue, Columbus announcing his discovery. The faces of the three courtiers receiving the news at the right-hand side of the stamp had been subtly altered to express uncontrollable fright. In the 3-cent Mothers of America issue, put out on Mother's Day, 1934, the flowers to the lower left of Whistler's mother had been replaced by Venus's flytrap, belladonna, poisoned sumac, and a few others Oedipa had never seen. In the 1947 postage stamp centenary issue, commemorating the great postal reform that had meant the beginning of the end for private carriers, the head of a Pony Express rider at the lower left was set at a disturbing angle unknown among the living. The deep violet 3-cent regular issue of 1954 had a faint, menacing smile on the face of the Statue of Liberty. The Brussels Exhibition issue of 1958, included in its aerial view of the U.S. Pavilion at Brussels, and set slightly off from the other tiny fairgoers, the unmistakable silhouette of a horse and rider. There were also the Pony Express stamp Cohen had showed her on her first visit, the Lincoln 4-cent with U.S. Potsage, the sinister 8-cent airmail she'd seen on the tattooed sailor's letter in San Francisco. "Well, it's interesting," she said, "if the article's legitimate." "That ought to be easy to check out," Bortz gazing straight into her eyes. "Why don't you?" The toothaches got worse. She dreamed of disembodied voices from whose malignance there was no appeal, the soft dusk of mirrors out of which something was about to walk, and empty rooms that waited for her. Your gynecologist has no test for what she was pregnant with. One day, Cohen called to tell her that the final arrangements had been made to auction off Inverarity's stamp collection. The Tristero forgeries were to be sold as Lot 49. "And something rather disturbing, Ms. Moss. A new book bidder has appeared on the scene, whom neither I nor any of the firms in the area have heard of before. That hardly ever happens.
A what?
Cohen explained how there were floor bidders who would attend the auction in person, and book bidders who would send in their bids by mail. These bids would be entered in a special book by the auction firm, hence the name. There would be, as was customary, no public disclosure of persons for whom the book would be bidding.
Then how do you know he's a stranger?
Word gets around. He's being super secretive, working through an agent, C. Morris Schrift, a very reputable, good man. Morris was in touch with the auctioneers yesterday to tell them his client wanted to examine our forgeries, Lot 49, in advance. Normally, there's no objection if they know who wants to see the lot, and if he's willing to pay all the postage and insurance and get everything back inside of 24 hours. But Morris got quite mysterious about the whole thing, wouldn't tell his client's name or anything else about him, except that as far as Morris knew, he was an outsider. So being a conservative house, naturally, they apologized and said no.
What do you think? Said Oedipa, already knowing pretty much.
That our mysterious bidder may be from Tristero, Cohen said. And saw the description of the lot in the auction catalog, and wants to keep evidence that Tristero exists out of unauthorized hands. I wonder what kind of a price they'll offer.
Oedipa went back to Echo Quartz to drink bourbon until the sun went down, and it was as dark as it would ever get. Then she went out and drove on the freeway for a while with her lights out to see what would happen. But angels were watching. Shortly after midnight, she found herself in a phone booth in a desolate, unfamiliar, unlit district of San Narciso. She put in a station call to the Greek Way in San Francisco, gave the musical voice that answered a description of the acneed, fuzz-headed Inamorato Anonymous she'd talked to there, and waited, inexplicable tears beginning to build up pressure around her eyes. Half a minute of clinking glasses, bursts of laughter, sounds of a jukebox. Then he came on.
"This is Arnold Snarb," she said, choking up.
"I was in the little boy's room," he said. "The men's room was full."
She told him quickly, using up no more than a minute, what she'd learned about the Tristero, what had happened to Hilarius, Mucho, Metzger, Driblet, Fallopian.
"So you are," she said. "The only one I have. I don't know your name, don't want to. But I have to know whether they arranged it with you, to run into me by accident and tell me your story about the post horn. Because it may be a practical joke for you, but it stopped being one for me a few hours ago. I got drunk and went driving on these freeways. Next time I may be more deliberate. For the love of God, human life, whatever you respect, please help me."
"Arnold," he said. There was a long stretch of bar noise.
"It's over," she said. "They've saturated me. From here on, I'll only close them out. You're free, released. You can tell me."
"It's too late," he said.
"For me?"
"For me."
Before she could ask what he meant, he'd hung up. She had no more coins. By the time she could get somewhere to break a bill, he'd be gone. She stood between the public booth and the rented car, in the night, her isolation complete, and tried to face toward the sea. But she'd lost her bearings. She turned, pivoting on one stacked heel, could find no mountains either, as if there could be no barriers between herself and the rest of the land. San Narciso at that moment lost. The loss, pure, instant, spherical, the sound of a stainless orchestral chime held among the stars and struck lightly. Gave up its residue of uniqueness for her, became a name again, was assumed back into the American continuity of crust and mantle. Pierce Inverarity was really dead. She walked down a stretch of railroad track next to the highway. Spurs ran off here and there into factory property. Pierce may have owned these factories, too. But did it matter now if he'd owned all of San Narciso? San Narciso was a name, an incident among our climactic records of dreams and what dreams became among our accumulated daylight. A moment's squall line or tornado's touchdown among the higher, more continental solemnities, storm systems of group suffering and need, prevailing winds of affluence. There was the true continuity. San Narciso had no boundaries. No one knew yet how to draw them. She had dedicated herself weeks ago to making sense of what Inverarity had left behind, never suspecting that the legacy was America. Might Oedipa Mas yet be his heiress? Had that been in the will, in code, perhaps without Pierce really knowing, having been by then too seized by some headlong expansion of himself, some visit, some lucid instruction? Though she could never again call back any image of the dead man to dress up, pose, talk to, and make answer, neither would she lose a new compassion for the cul-de-sac he tried to find a way out of, for the enigma his efforts had created. Though he had never talked business with her, she had known it to be a fraction of him that couldn't come out even, would carry forever beyond any decimal place she might name. Her love, such as it had been, remaining incommensurate with his need to possess, to alter the land, to bring new skylines, personal antagonisms, growth rates into being. "Keep it bouncing," he'd told her once. "That's all the secret. Keep it bouncing." He must have known, writing the will, facing the specter, how the bouncing would stop. He might have written the testament only to harass a one-time mistress, so cynically sure of being wiped out he could throw away all hope of anything more. Bitterness could have run that deep in him. She just didn't know. He might himself have discovered the Tristero and encrypted that in the will, buying into just enough to be sure she'd find it. Or he might even have tried to survive death as a paranoia, as a pure conspiracy against someone he loved. Would that breed of perversity prove at last too keen to be stunned even by death? Had a plot finally been devised too elaborate for the Dark Angel to hold at once, in his humorless vice president's head, all the possibilities of? Had something slipped through, an Inverarity, by that much beaten death? Yet she knew, head down, stumbling along over the cinder bed and its old sleepers, there was still that other chance, that it was all true, that Inverarity had only died, nothing else. Suppose, God, there really was a Tristero then, and that she had come on it by accident. If San Narciso and the estate were really no different from any other town, any other estate, then by that continuity she might have found the Tristero anywhere in her republic, through any of 100 lightly concealed entranceways, 100 alienations, if only she'd looked. She stopped a minute between the steel rails, raising her head as if to sniff the air. Becoming conscious of the hard-strung presence she stood on, knowing as if maps had been flashed for her on the sky how these tracks ran on into others, others, knowing they laced, deepened, authenticated the great night around her. If only she'd looked. She remembered now old Pullman cars, left where the money'd run out or the customers vanished, amid green farm flatnesses, where clothes hung, smoke lazed out of jointed pipes. Were the squatters there in touch with others through Tristero? Were they helping carry forward that 300 years of the house's disinheritance? Surely they'd forgotten by now what it was the Tristero were to have inherited, as perhaps Oedipa one day might have. What was left to inherit? That America coded in Inverarity's testament? Whose was that? She thought of other immobilized freight cars, where the kids sat on the floor planking and sang back, happy as fat, whatever came over the mother's pocket radio. Of other squatters who stretched canvas for lean-tos behind smiling billboards along all the highways, or slept in junkyards in the stripped shells of wrecked Plymouths, or even, daring, spent the night up some pole in a lineman's tent, like caterpillars, swung among a web of telephone lines, living in the very copper rigging and secular miracle of communication, untroubled by the dumb voltages flickering their miles the night long in the thousands of unheard messages. She remembered drifters she had listened to, Americans speaking their language carefully, scholarly, as if they were in exile from somewhere else, invisible yet congruent with the cheered land she lived in, and walkers along the roads at night, zooming in and out of your headlights without looking up, too far from any town to have a real destination, and the voices before and after the dead man's that had phoned at random during the darkest, slowest hours, searching ceaseless among the dial's 10 million possibilities for that magical other who would reveal herself out of the roar of relays, monotone litanies of insult, filth, fantasy, love, whose brute repetition must someday call into being the trigger for the unnameable act, the recognition, the word. How many shared Tristero's secret as well as its exile? What would the probate judge have to say about spreading some kind of a legacy among them all those nameless, maybe as a first installment? Oh, boy, he'd be on her ass in a microsecond, revoke her letters testamentary. They'd call her names, proclaim her through all Orange County as a redistributionist and pinko. Slip the old man from warp, wistful Kubitschek and McMingus in as administrator de bonis known, and so much baby for code, constellations, shadow legatees. Who knew? Perhaps she'd be hounded some day as far as joining Tristero itself, if it existed, in its twilight, its aloofness, its waiting. The waiting above all. If not for another set of possibilities to replace those that had conditioned the land to accept any San Narciso among its most tender flesh without a reflex or a cry, then at least, at the very least, waiting for symmetry of choices to break down, to go skew. She had heard all about excluded middles. They were bad shit to be avoided. And how had it ever happened here, with the chances once so good for diversity? For it was now like walking among matrices of a great digital computer, the zeros and ones twinned above, hanging like balanced mobiles right and left, ahead, thick, maybe endless. Behind the hieroglyphic streets, there would either be a transcendent meaning or only the earth. In the songs Miles, Dean, Serge, and Leonard sang, was either some fraction of the truth's numinous beauty, as Mucho now believed, or only a power spectrum. Tremaine, the swastika salesman's reprieve from Holocaust, was either an injustice or the absence of a wind. The bones of the GIs at the bottom of Lake Inverarity were there either for a reason that mattered to the world or for skin divers and cigarette smokers. Ones and zeros. So did the couples arrange themselves. At Vesperhaven House, either an accommodation reached in some kind of dignity with the angel of death, or only death and the daily tedious preparations for it. Another mode of meaning behind the obvious, or none. Either Oedipa in the orbiting ecstasy of a true paranoia, or a real Tristero. for there either was some Tristero beyond the appearance of the legacy America, or there was just America. And if there was just America, then it seemed the only way she could continue and manage to be at all relevant to it was as an alien, unfurrowed, assumed full circle into some paranoia. Next day, with the courage you find you have when there is nothing more to lose, she got in touch with C. Morris Schrift and inquired after his mysterious client. "He decided to attend the auction in person," was all Schrift would tell her. "You might run into him there." She might. The auction was duly held on a Sunday afternoon in perhaps the oldest building in San Narciso, dating from before World War II. Edipa arrived a few minutes early, alone, and in a cold lobby of gleaming redwood floorboards and the smell of wax and paper. She met Genghis Cohen, who looked genuinely embarrassed.
"Please don't call it a conflict of interests," he drawled earnestly. "There were some lovely Mozambique triangles I couldn't quite resist. May I ask if you've come to bid, Ms. Moss?"
"No," said Edipa. "I'm only being a busybody."
"We're in luck. Lauren Passerin, the finest auctioneer in the West, will be crying today."
"Will be what?"
"We say an auctioneer cries a sale," Cohen said.
"Your fly is open," whispered Edipa.
She was not sure what she'd do when the bidder revealed himself. She had only some vague idea about causing a scene violent enough to bring the cops into it and find out that way who the man really was. She stood in a patch of sun among brilliant rising and falling points of dust, trying to get a little warm, wondering if she'd go through with it.
"It's time to start," said Genghis Cohen, offering his arm.
The men inside the auction room wore black mohair and had pale, cruel faces. They watched her come in, trying each to conceal his thoughts. Lauren Passerin, on his podium, hovered like a puppet master, his eyes bright, his smile practiced and relentless. He stared at her, smiling, as if saying, "I'm surprised you actually came." Edipa sat alone toward the back of the room, looking at the napes of necks, trying to guess which one was her target, her enemy, perhaps her proof. An assistant closed the heavy door on the lobby windows and the sun. She heard a lock snap shut. The sound echoed a moment. Passerin spread his arms in a gesture that seemed to belong to the priesthood of some remote culture, perhaps to a descending angel. The auctioneer cleared his throat. Edipa settled back to await the crying of Lot 49.
The End. You've been listening to The Crying of Lot 49. By Thomas Pynchon, narrated by George Wilson, and directed by Jeff Barron.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.